Good morning. I'd like to bring to order the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection. And I would like to call the Senate Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor to order. Today is November 6th. Is that right?
No.
By the 9th.
Turn the 6th off.
Dyslexic in north and south kind of way.
A little too much travel, perhaps. But it is November 9th, 2007. Today, we're having an informational hearing just to get a further update on the mortgage lending work group. We'll be listening to a number of folks from that work group, starting out with DCBS, Corey Streichinger, and Lou Savage, who are heading up the Governor's Task Force on Mortgage Lending. And we'll listen to everything from the task force and have a little discussion, and be my intent at the end of this to have a motion to have legislation drafted on mortgage lending concepts. So with that, I would like to call up Corey Streichinger and Lou Savage, please.
You want to report from staff?
Staff, you have the report?
Actually, no, Mr. Chair. DCBS, what we'll be doing is that Corey will begin with an overview of what the task force has been doing. And then Lou will start the discussions of an introduction of the four subcommittees that will be presenting information to the committees. And we'll be bringing up folks from each of the subs to discuss the three legislative concepts that the entire task force has agreed upon to move forward for February.
Okay. That's kind of what I said. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is Lou Savage, Senior Policy Advisor in the Department. And we did appear before you a few weeks ago to talk about what the work group was getting into. The work group has been meeting regularly. The full work group has met three times, and there have been extensive subcommittee meetings as well. We have given you a list of members of the work group, which I think you've got in front of you. It's large and I think diverse, and I want to express my appreciation for the participation of everybody who has put the time in. It's been encouraging to see how many people are very engaged in helping find solutions in a number of these areas. And I would point out, in addition to the people who are formally listed as members of the work group, there have been a number of regular participants as well in the room, and the work group structure provides opportunity for comment and input for those attendees who are not part of the formal work group as well. So I think it's been a lot of very useful discussion, and again, I want to express my appreciation for the time that so many people have put in, including, of course, a number of members of this committee. We are intending to continue to meet. What we have been doing is the work group has been meeting roughly every 2 weeks, with the committees meeting on the alternate week. We have had committee meetings this week, and next week the full work group is going to meet again. Our goal is to have concepts in a form that, in fact, can be meet your deadlines for introduction, get the drafting started, but then have the work group continue to meet to fine-tune and continue to work on language, and then possibly including leading up to the session if needed. When the governor asked us to set up this work group, he also anticipated that there would be issues that would not come up during the February 08 session, but he has asked the work group to continue looking at these issues if needed during the interim leading up to the regular 2009 session. So there have been several committees meeting regularly, one of them not dealing with policy recommendations but with data. You heard some of that last time. You'll hear more about it today. But the feeling among many participants in the work group was that it's very important to get a clear understanding of what the data shows us, what we know, what we don't know, what there's agreement on, and what there's not agreement on. So you're going to hear a little about that today. The other committees have been focusing more on substantive recommendations, and and you will hear reports today in three overall areas. The first is what are sometimes called mortgage rescue arrangements, mortgage rescue schemes that can include people who provide counseling or purport to provide advice on what you can do to save your credit and stay out of foreclosure. The advice may or may, services may or may not be actually provided. And then also a group of people who engage in transactions that may involve your actually turning over title to your house and possibly getting it back and possibly not. So that cluster of issues has been the focus of the first committee. There has been a committee also looking at the foreclosure process with a particular focus on information, the notices that go to a consumer facing foreclosure, what information should a borrower be given in order to be able to make good decisions. And then the a third committee looking at enforcement issues, at the moment focusing particularly on the issue of loan originators. That committee has not met quite as, it got a later start than the others and probably is going to have one more meeting before the next work group meeting. So there may be other issues that come up in that enforcement committee, but at the moment there has been a focus on individual loan originators. There has been some discussion in the work group about broader issues having to do with lending practices, but at the moment it does not appear that consensus is going to come forward on those issues. So the work group has been focusing on these areas dealing with the foreclosure process in particular. We are, of course, also monitoring the federal activity, and there is federal legislation that's getting consideration. House Resolution 3915 has moved out of House committee. Obviously, we don't know whether or not the bill will move all the way through the process, but it is something that we're keeping an eye on as well because it addresses a number of the issues that have been of concern to all of us. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you have or turn it over to Lou for further discussion of the committee work.
Senator Brzezinski, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up, Corey, on your last statement about the federal legislation that's pending. Could you tell us if it should make it all the way through, what impact it would have on all of Oregon institutions, not just the federal chartered ones? And also, second question of that would be, let's say they come up with something more narrow than what our work group would want to consider, or us as a committee may want, would we be preempted from being able to go beyond whatever they may have in the federal resolution legislation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brzezinski, the bill, in at least in its current form, provides that mortgage originators are subject to a federal duty of care, and that applies to mortgage brokers and depository institutions that originate mortgages, that is, banks and credit unions, and state and federal. So it would be a uniformly applicable to the institutions that we regulate and the institutions that are federally regulated. With respect to preemption, as I'm sure you know, there's two types of preemption, and one of them is if there is a specific direct conflict between federal law and state law, federal law always prevails. And so if we were to come up with something that would be inconsistent with the federal law, then the federal law would prevail. And we at the moment aren't aware of provisions that where there would be a flat inconsistency, but I will say we have not been, you know, line by line through the federal legislation. And of course, we haven't landed on the absolute details of ours yet either. I do not believe that there is a broad general field type preemption in this draft bill. That is, that's the second type of preemption. The federal government, it can certainly say this is the federal standard and states can't do anything different. To the best of my knowledge, although we will check, this bill does not preempt separate state standards.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I may.
Senator Westland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, let me ask you the unanswerable question, but perhaps you could shed what information you know. Do you know of any timelines or anticipated expectations of when should this thing actually pass? It would pass. Or the more cynical part of the question is: look, it's just window dressing from the feds to address, you know, what they perceive to be a political issue, as opposed to really trying to solve the problem.
Well,
that's two questions.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, both of them are, of course, unanswerable.
Yes.
And in fact, I do not know. I'm not close enough to the federal politics at this point to tell. There's a great deal of interest in this issue at the federal level, and I wouldn't characterize it as window dressing. There's serious interest in this issue because it's been having such a large impact on the economy. So there are a large range of interests in play here. The time frame and what the bill's chances of passage are, I couldn't guess. I don't know, Lou, whether you've heard anything further.
Well, the only other thing I would add, Senator West, Lou Savage, Senior Policy Advisor, Department of Consumer and Business Services, there is not a companion bill in the Senate at this point, and it takes that to move it forward. So I would suspect that there will be a companion bill introduced at some point, but there's not one yet. So that gives you an indication in terms of the timeline.
Further questions? Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have has to do with, can this legislation wait until 2009? Is this truly an emergency that we need to deal with in the interim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, actually that's a good lead into the data report, because one of the issues we've been concerned about is, are we going to see an increase in foreclosures, and if so, when and how many? And I think my answer to that is actually we are likely to see an increase in foreclosures that would be sooner than legislation coming out of the 09 session would address. So for the issues that that the work group has been focusing on, dealing with the foreclosure process, I think actually this is a time that allows us to get to some extent in front of the problem.
Further questions? Thank you very much for your report and your work on this issue.
And I'm going to turn it over then to Lou to shepherd the rest of this through.
Okay, and we'll save our questions for him then.
Absolutely.
Okay. Lou, go ahead.
Chair Wesley, Chair Holvey, I'm going to ask Barry Leslie to come up and make the presentation on the data subcommittee. Barry is the manager of the mortgage lending section for Division of Finance and Corporate Security, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Good morning. As Lou mentioned, my name is Barry Leslie, and I am the manager of the Mortgage Lending Program, which is part of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of the larger agency of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today representing the Mortgage Lending Workgroup's Data Subcommittee, which included a number of interested parties from both the lending community and consumer advocates. The Data Committee was assigned to help the larger work group kind of get a better understanding of the current picture of the foreclosure issue in Oregon. And after an initial review and look at the available data and a lot of significant debate, what we agreed is that because there are so many different data sources and so many of them have a lot of really good qualities and a lot of detractors, that it would be better for us just to bring policymakers and other interested parties a presentation of the data, and then let you folks decide whether or not you think there's a current problem in Oregon or whether you believe there might be a problem in the future. So that's the presentation that I'm going to be talking to you from today, and I don't know if you have it in your packets. I want to draw your attention to it. Great, you've got a color copy. I've got my black and white here. What we're hoping folks will take away from this presentation is an idea of the data that's available about Oregon currently, an idea about the projections that you're probably hearing about in the media in terms of foreclosure, and then a few other questions that I think you have to answer when you're talking about this subject, which include how many Oregonians have adjustable rate mortgages that are going to be resetting, how many of these properties are investor occupied, and then last, what the market's doing in terms of home values, because obviously all of these questions are really critical when it comes to understanding the total real estate economy for Oregon. So we can go ahead and get started. This took about 75 minutes at the larger work group. Obviously, not going to use near as much time for that today, so I'm going to be shuffling through it rather quickly. Feel free to stop and ask me questions at each slide or wait till the end, whatever's best for you. You'll notice that on the back of each slide, there are some significant notes that not only talk about the contributing data source for each slide, but also provide you with either any comments or disclaimers that the group felt were important for anyone viewing this presentation to see. So that's what those notes are there for. So starting with, it's your page 2 with the title of MBA Foreclosure Data All Loans. This first slide is just to give you a picture of the foreclosure situation in Oregon now. And again, this is from the Mortgage Bankers Association related to all loans. You'll see that this gives you a look at second quarter 2007 over second quarter 2005, and then it characterizes the number of households, the percentage change since 2005, and then in the last column, Oregon's rank as it compares nationally. In all of the slides that we put together, we tried to do a two-year perspective and comparing that two-year period rather than doing an annual comparison or a quarterly percentage, which can sometimes be skewed. So we really liked the Mortgage Bankers Association data because it does represent about 80% of all mortgage lenders. Moving on to slide two. This is foreclosure data, again, from the Mortgage Bankers Association, but this time they're talking about subprime conventional loans. So it's a smaller category of lending that's done. And again, you'll see it's the same second quarter 07 over 05 comparison. And again, it looks at number of households and percentage change from 2005. And you'll see here that Oregon has dropped a little bit to 48th in the country instead of 49th when compared to all loans. Moving on to slide number three, this is to try to give folks an impression of the national default and foreclosure trends. So you're looking at three categories, number of defaults, number of foreclosure starts, and total foreclosure inventory. And you'll see in all of those categories for that last two-year period, there have been significant increases at a national level. The next slide is default and foreclosure trends. Again, this is the national perspective. And what this does is it breaks it down into three different types of loans, prime, government-issued, and subprime. And you'll see in the last two-year period, there have been significant increases in all of these categories with the exception of government-issued loans. The next slide is RealtyTrack foreclosure data, and RealtyTrack is probably the number one used foreclosure statistic database by folks in the media, so we thought it was really important to include this because you're going to hear their numbers used a lot. And this is, again, a two-year comparison, third quarter 07 over third quarter 05 this time, and you'll see that the first four categories are Oregon-specific and the last four are related to national numbers, so you'll see that the percentage change for Oregon has been 73% as compared to the United States, which saw 190% increase. The concerns that you'll hear about RealtyTrack, and again, this is all characterized on the notes page, are that some foreclosures may be double-counted because the data is not properly sorted. And also, oftentimes when you hear RealtyTrack numbers, they're comparing states, which is difficult to do because states have very different foreclosure laws, which means that data can be easily skewed depending upon how long a foreclosure process actually takes in each state. So that was the concern about the RealtyTrack data. The next two slides are from the Center for Responsible Lending, and this is where we get into the category of foreclosure projections. And I want to just do a general disclaimer now on behalf of the subcommittee that any of the slides related to projections were slides we didn't reach consensus about. And what that meant is that we wanted you to have the information. You're going to be hearing about it in the media, and we think it's important for you to know, but we didn't necessarily agree on the validity of the data or on the projection itself. So that explains the disclaimer you'll see on those. What this first slide is looking at is a cohort approach to analyzing loan performance. So this cohort approach looks at 1998 through 2001 for a specific pool of subprime loans originated in that period. So the cohort approach analyzes the performance of the loan over the life of its loan. And on this first slide, the reason it says observed and projected is that some of these have been observed in the sense that some of them have foreclosed already, while others, they're still waiting to see what's going to happen with that loan. So for an Oregon total of that cohort of loans, you're looking at about 14, the projection that about 14.3% of those will go into foreclosure. The next Center for Responsible Lending slide looks at a different loan cohort, of the cohort of 2005 to 2006, and these are only projected because there haven't been any observed foreclosures on these yet, and you'll see that they're projecting about 19.6% of these loans will go into foreclosure. The next slide is just to answer that question that I think a lot of people have asked, which is how many Oregonians are in high-cost loans or higher-cost loans? And when I use the term higher cost, what I'm talking about is the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act's definition of higher cost, which right now for a first lien is anywhere between 8-9%, and for a second lien is anywhere between 10-11%. So what this slide is telling you is that in 2004, 12.1% of Oregonians had loans that were in the higher cost category, and that number has nearly doubled in 2006 to be 24% of Oregonians with these types of loans. The next slide, also from the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, just tells you in the different Oregon metropolitan service areas where that higher incidence of high-cost loans are occurring. So, for example, in Marion and Columbia County, 24-28% of loans meet that definition of higher cost. Slide 12 is another foreclosure projection, and it's by the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. Again, it's broken down into metropolitan service areas, and it just gives you their projection of, in those MSAs, what they think the expected delinquency rate will be. Slide 13 is an attempt to answer the question of how many of the transactions that we're talking about are for non-owner-occupied homes and how many are Oregon families. So in Oregon, 14 to 22% of all transactions are non-owner-occupied. The next couple of slides are to give folks a better idea about adjustable rate mortgages and what it means to have one and the impact that you might experience if you have an adjustable rate mortgage that's going to reset. What this is essentially explaining is that if you took out a loan in 2005 or 2006 and it was a loan that had a teaser feature, which means a very short-term introductory period, and then your loan was also going to reset in that same year that it was originated, then your payments would probably double after reset. Whereas if you took out a loan in 05 and 06 and you had a two-year period before reset, your loan payment would increase by 25 to 40%. So it gives you a little bit of an idea of the impact to that person. And then if you want to look at that in the next slide, on slide 15, the actual dollar amount that means for an Oregonian would be, for a typical market rate loan, an additional about $500 a month. For a typical teaser rate loan, again, that means a loan with a short-term introductory period, your average increase is going to be about $1,500 a month. And then for a typical subprime loan, they're going to be facing a monthly payment increase of about $400 a month. So that tells you just the impact in terms of budgeting that would have on a person.
Leslie, before you go on, I have just a quick little question.
Please.
Going back to the slide where you showed that 14 to 22% were non-owner occupied loans, can we, make the assumption that 14 to 22% of the projected foreclosures are also non-owner occupied?
Chair Holby, I'm not sure if we can make that assumption, but that's something that we could probably look into and bring back to you.
Thank you. I'd kind of like to know that, if possible. I don't know if it's possible or not.
I believe the Mortgage Bankers Association has done some research about that, so we could certainly bring that back.
Thank you, Chair Holman. The question I have is, you just gave that in contrast, a typical teaser rate loan will face an average payment increase of $1,511.98 per month. What's the average home price that that's predicated on?
Chair Holby, Representative Gerard, great question. And there's, I think, two or three slides from here we talk about median home values. And so that might answer your question. Slide number 16 is an attempt to try to answer the question that I think a lot of us have had, which is how many Oregonians are in adjustable rate mortgages, particularly those that are going to be experiencing some type of reset in the near term. So in this case, what we're looking at is loans that will be resetting in the next 18 months. What this does is it breaks it down into two categories, Alt-A, which are your borrowers who have not great credit but aren't in that subprime category, so they're somewhere in the middle, and then folks who are in the subprime category. What this says essentially is that more than 15,000 Oregonians have loans that will be resetting in the next 18 months. And then on the far right, even more interestingly, we were just delighted to be able to get this information, it talks about the percentage of equity that that pool of borrowers has in their home. So that's not the percentage of equity for each individual borrower, but rather as a group, what percentage of equity they have. So you'll see that on the next slide, where it talks about percent of equity in home, it shows you how that compares to those same borrowers, that same pool of borrowers in other states. So Oregon's doing somewhat better than some states in the West and not as good as others. Slide number 18 just looks at median home values since 2003 for the different counties in Oregon. And that's just to give you a better idea of what it costs for people on average to get into homes. And then slide 19 talks about the annual appreciation in median home value since 2004. And as you can see in these different areas, we had really terrific years for appreciation in 2005 and 2006 and have seen less appreciation in 2007 and in places like Medford, an actual just leveling of appreciation completely. The second to last slide is our effort just to really do a snapshot of foreclosure projections generally. So what this is essentially saying is that in Oregon there are 88,000 subprime loans, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association, and that the various organizations making projections, for example, the Center for Responsible Lending is forecasting that of those loans, more than 17,000 will go into foreclosure. The Joint Economic Committee, which is a congressional committee, is projecting that more than 12,000 will go into foreclosure. And looking at the folks in our information management division did a just historical analysis of foreclosure averages. And so if we were to continue as is, there would be almost 8,000 borrowers going into foreclosure in the next 2.5 years. And the last slide, of course, is just the index to show you where we found all of this information. This was just a tremendous amount of information that was pulled together, and besides myself, most of the folks who participated on our subcommittee were volunteers putting the time together, and none of us, with the exception of one, are economists or researchers or any of the above, so that's probably the biggest disclaimer of all. But for folks who want to go back and read some of these reports in their entirety, this is how those can be made available to you. So I would be delighted to answer any other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know Senator Wesson will be reading all the reports in their entirety. Isn't that right?
You know, these are all busy people. Don't waste their time. They know that. Don't tell them
what
they already know.
Point well taken. Ms. Leslie, so from your committee, from your perspective, because we have a little, obviously there are a lot of data sources, and in terms of the credibility of the sources, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about, for example, you have RealtyTrack.
Mm-hmm.
Who finances RealtyTrack? Who are they? Same Center for Responsible Lending, and then First American Core. And when we're trying to analyze the credibility of these organizations, are they interest groups that have a particular interest? I think that's important for us to know, and you probably know better than most.
Chair Holby, Representative Glizio, that's a great question, and one that we obviously struggle with a lot on the subcommittee, and you'll see, and really that this report will be more meaningful to you after you've had a chance to really digest it on your own and read all the notes. We've put a lot of that into the notes. I think we all agree that the Mortgage Bankers Association provided really good data. They can speak better than I can to whether or not they're an interest group. The First American CoreLogic is a great data source, and it's one that's actually being used at the national level. RealtyTrack is a business that actually is in the business of promoting foreclosure purchases by investors and others. The Center for Responsible Lending is also an interest group. So I'm really probably not answering your question. I can tell you that it was something we really struggled with as a committee, and that's why we felt it was important to bring all of these to you.
Yeah, thank you. I think for whomever is going to speak to us, it'll be really helpful, at least from my perspective, to know who finances these groups. That's what I want to know. So, just for the record, thank you for that.
Representative Nelson, good to have you with us. You have a question?
Thank you, and I really apologize for being late. Thank you very much for that remark. Glad to be back. Yes, thank you for this report. I'm just curious on the tracking. We talked about appreciation, and we just had a shock trauma in one of my counties, which is Sham Hill, which includes McMinnville, Newburgh area, where in 1 year, the tax assessor changed the base of his computations, and many of us, like myself, found that our land had been increased in 1 year $70,000, which is a huge increase in taxes. So as we look at this, we haven't really talked about cause, and maybe y'all are going to do this. What really is causing these foreclosures, the loss of jobs, income, things like just happened to us. We're going to have a coup in my county because of it. But people just can't afford the increased burden. Do you have information on the cause of these foreclosures?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Nelson, a lot of the different organizations that have done foreclosure projections actually try to factor in job loss, economic forecasting, all kinds of different things that impact foreclosure beyond just somebody not being able to make their payments because the loan's resetting. So my understanding is that particularly the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act really does a good job of really defining all of those kinds of causes beyond just the obvious of a mortgage payment.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Thank you for that information. Could we get the data, kind of following along with what Larry said, could we find out what data they have to substantiate this information? And because I'm the dumbest person up here on this panel, could you please define subprime to me?
Sure, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Nelson. Subprime is a category of borrower that is generally speaking, a credit score of, if there's any lenders in the room, correct me, less than 680. But it doesn't always necessarily just relate to a credit score. It's usually somebody who has experienced blemishes on their credit over time, perhaps a bankruptcy or significant missed payments. It can be a number of factors, and actually the FDIC has done a good job of characterizing the subprime borrower, and I'd be happy to get you that analysis.
Would you please?
I would be happy to do that.
Representative Riley, a question?
Yes, thank you. You just described who the subprime borrower is, but could you tell us what our subprime mortgage is? I think that is more to your question.
Oh, okay. Chair Hobie, Representative Riley, a subprime mortgage is generally characterized by a higher interest rate. I used the example of higher cost lending earlier and the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act's definition of higher cost, which is generally for a first lien, 3 percentage points above the Treasury security, which right now would be between 8 and 9%, and 5 points for a second lien above the Treasury security, which would put a loan at between 10 and 11%. That's not an exact definition of a subprime loan, but I think the folks at the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act would tell you that the folks who work with that act, that that's generally going to be a subprime loan.
That answers your question.
Senator Krasnowski.
So just following up, Ms. Leslie, basically those subprime loans are made to people that may have good risk, and so they're going to potentially have a greater interest rate because of that risk.
Mr. Chair, Senator Krasnowski, exactly. The assumption is you're paying a higher interest rate because your loan might be a greater risk to lend money on.
Representative Nelson, one last question.
Yes, one last question, please. Could I find out why Nevada is so low in the percent of equity? It's interesting to me that it's 3% and everybody else is, maybe some law or something we ought to pass to, I don't know. But what I was wondering is, does this information include VA loans or just commercial loans?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Nelson, which slide are you looking at? Any of them?
Uh-huh.
The foreclosure, do they include the VA? For example, the Mortgage Bankers Association slide, which is related to subprime conventional loans, does not include.
These are all commercial.
Yes.
Representative Barmici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Barry. I wanted to talk about slide number 10 about high-cost loans, because that does show almost a doubling in the percentage of high-cost loans. And on the back in the notes, it says that the definition of high-cost loans does not directly mean subprime. But can you just talk a little bit about the relationship between high-cost loans and subprime, and how many of these, because we're seeing almost a doubling here, how many of those do you expect are subprime, of those high-cost loans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, we talked about this at length both in our work group, and I, of course, talk about this with other regulators, and our best assumption is that the majority of high-cost loans are what we would consider subprime loans. I'm sorry, I can't remember the second half of your question. I apologize.
No, that's fine.
Okay.
I just wanted to get a sense of, if we're seeing a doubling in high-cost loans, are we seeing a doubling in subprime loans?
I think that's an appropriate characterization.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you very much for this report on this data. It's really, really important. I would reiterate to the committee to take a look when you're looking at these slides of the notes that are on the back of the slides. It's really important information.
What if your slides don't have the notes?
They're on the back page.
Well, that was just for you.
Yeah.
I got the set B.
It's a need-to-know basis.
Lawyers don't need the information. They'll just make it up.
I'm listening to all these notes. I'm kind of looking. I see the good senator next to me has notes all over the back of his slides. Well, I would have showed for everyone. Everyone got the same set. They may have a better credit rating.
I will get you a special copy.
I think it has something to do with who's running this committee today. I don't know.
Thank you. Could I just ask one last question, Leslie? So I'm trying to understand this. I'm really working at it. Trust me. How do we determine what percentage of the foreclosures, I mean, what's the value of the homes relative to these percentages of foreclosures? Are they, you know, $500,000 homes with balloon payments that are causing the foreclosures? Are they $200,000, you know, that make up this percentage? Could you give us that data?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Nelson, I'll have to go back and
thank
look
you
at that. That's a terrific question, and one that we haven't even looked into yet.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we're going back. Senator, as long as it's not a question, and I want to.
It's not a question, it's a comment. First of all, I want to assure Representative Galizio that I have read the notes on the back. But we look at, and as you read them, you know, I'm reminded of the old Mark Twain saw, you know, lies, damnable lies, and statistics. And you know, look at particularly some of the earlier slides where it shows Oregon's, you know, 49th or 47th or 48th, and we're going, okay, that's good. You know, that means, you know, Oregon's only 2 inches below water, where the rest of the, you know, country might be 2 feet below water. Fact is, if you're 2 inches below water, you're still drowning. And that this is a significant issue for Oregonians. And it's one that we, as public policymakers, have a responsibility to get our, you know, collective minds around and propose the appropriate policy. You know, for all the work group members that have come so dutifully and, you know, attended so frequently, we're working really well. And then you get to the statistics part, and it's just the gun and knife club. But it's still one of those things where I'll just stop there, Mr. Chair, but I just wanted to make that comment.
Thank you. Ms. Leslie, thank you very much for your testimony. that subcommittee. And Lou, would you like to bring us forward on the agenda?
Chair Hovey, Chair Weston, I thought I was going to have a little help on a couple of these, but I think I'll be able to manage on my own. And there is a silent partner up next to you, Chair Hovey. In addition to the other participants from the legislature in the work group, Representative Bonamici in particular has pulled the heavy oar on a lot of these discussions. So I'm expecting her at some point to chime in when we're discussing these concepts.
She wouldn't be silent if she was to chime in. I can't imagine her being silent.
I can't either.
I was surprised that she's been silent.
It is.
My name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And the point that Chair Westland brought out at the very end of the discussion is actually a good one. There has been a fair amount of debate about the data which is available what weight we ought to be putting on various aspects and sources of that data. But for the purposes of the work group concepts that we're going to be talking about today, there really is broad consensus. I would say that there is a significant enough concern that there are some people, Oregonians, that are at risk, that there are some measures that ought to be taken to protect those folks. So regardless of where you would put that line in terms of foreclosures or potential foreclosures, there's a broad consensus in the work group that certain measures ought to be taken to protect those folks. So although the debate can go on as to what those numbers are, I think the bottom line is that industry, consumer groups are in agreement that there's some things that ought to be done. So that's a background for where we're at. The other thing I do want to say again is that the members of the work group have put in a lot of hours to try to come forward with these concepts, and we're talking about both work group meetings and subcommittee meetings, and these concepts are a work in progress. So when I go through these outlines, you should know that even as of yesterday, they have been tweaked and will continue to be worked on as we go forward, and hopefully some of these will move forward into the February session. So give you that as a background. The first concept that we talked about and we put together a subcommittee for was the agenda itself refers to it as Mortgage Rescue Subcommittee. It's really broken down into two parts. One is the foreclosure consultant, and the other is the equity purchaser. The foreclosure consultant, that is an industry that has really developed as a result of the increase in foreclosures throughout the country. And what the subcommittee has tried to do is to work on a concept which would define what those folks are doing that ought to be regulated and have some boundaries put around. If you take a look at the outline, the bullet points that kind of form the basis for this concept, it defines the foreclosure consultant in terms of what this person is attempting to do with respect to offering their services to a homeowner. And really the goal is to define this in a way that is clear, and also the next section provides some exemptions, because there are lots of folks in the industry who are doing things that do assist homeowners who are in danger of foreclosure. The industry had some very good points, and we worked very hard to make sure that you know, whether it's a lawyer, a person who is in the mortgage lending business, a broker, other folks who are in the business, this would not apply. They would be exempt from this. But there are other folks out in the community who basically have created a business specifically designed to, you know, help folks who are in danger of foreclosure, and we want to make sure that there are some guidelines that they need to follow with respect to those practices. The next page talks about what those requirements are. I'm not going to go through them in detail, but again, the goal is to give some guidance as to what those practices are, for example, one of the issues that we talked about a great deal was whether there ought to be a right to rescission or a right to cancel the agreement, and the work group decided on a 3-day right to cancel because that's a fairly typical time period for a right of rescission in a lot of other consumer transactions. Things like a writing and being very clear as to what the agreement is, the prohibition against a homeowner being able to waive certain statutory rights. The last bullet on that is the discussion that we had yesterday, actually, in the subcommittee about whether we ought to have the consultant be regulated under the Credit Services Organization statute, which would then give our agency the opportunity to have a licensing program so that they're really within a regulatory scheme. That's a really quick overview of that portion of it. And if you have any questions on that, I can answer them now, and then we can move on to the next section.
Is it possible we could wait and let him get through this, because we're going to run into time crunch if we don't, according to where we're headed now?
It just take me 1 minute, Mr. Chair.
Okay, darn it.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to find out, maybe you could send it to me. How are these people qualified, these consultants? And are they registered? And do they have to have some kind of license? I'm really upset about that issue. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Nelson, in fact, they are not regulated, and that's why we're taking a look at this. There are certain segments of the mortgage lending industry that do very good work in terms of consulting with people now, whether it's a nonprofit or a broker who has helped someone in the past. But then there's this other group of folks out there who are not regulated under any scheme, and that's the purpose of this concept.
And just following up, it's the rip-off of the senior citizens in this area that I think we need a lot of attention given to and go after them. I mean, legally, if we don't give them a definition, a qualification, a registration, what do we base going after them on, you know, legally? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to make a couple of general comments about how we started our approach on this particular issue with foreclosure consultants, and there really has been a proliferation of these. If you look at notices on lamps, light posts, or Craigslist, or bulletin boards, you'll see they really have increased in number. We are using, we started with a model based on other states. There's sort of a model act, and then we looked at several other states, just so that you know that we do have a framework from what's working in other states, and started there and went through their provisions and kind of compared states and came up with what we thought was the best of all the provisions. So, as background.
Thank you. Not so silent anymore.
Could I apologize in advance for Richard Devlin's tardiness and announce that Donna Nelson was the individual on the pool by my watch that actually came closest to his.
And I didn't know to arrange to have that door locked, so I had to carry this.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a go on record with a complaint about parking.
Okay. And I don't know that this is the correct committee chair to bring that up to, but so anyway, nice to have you here, Senator Devlin, as well, and you can come in anytime you want. So, with that, a little sorry about the interruptions. Can you remember where you were and keep going?
I do. We have the second piece of what we call the mortgage rescue concept, and that's the equity purchaser issue. When a homeowner is faced with foreclosure, they often have a significant equity in their home, and there's a great concern that folks will come in, be opportunistic, and basically take that equity out of the home, and the homeowner is left with little or no equity that they have gained over the period of time that they have owned the home. So this portion of the concept looks at that issue. It's a fairly complicated issue because there is a concern that a legitimate concern that's been expressed that at some point there needs to be closure on what's happening with a deed. So in other words, if someone is working with a homeowner is working with an individual, and there's an equity issue, and it's unclear as to where the ownership lies at this point. There needs to be some clear boundaries as to what is going on, because if there is a bona fide purchaser in line who ultimately does buy the property, they need to be assured that in fact they are getting clear title. And we're working very closely with the title insurance companies and other folks who are in the business of buying and selling real estate to make sure that we thread the needle correctly on this. And we had a very interesting discussion, which I'm not sure anybody would be interested in hearing other than Representative Bonamici, who spent about a half an hour talking about it yesterday, the issue of equitable mortgages.
I can add to that if the chair will oblige.
I think you have to now.
The National Consumer Law Center is looking at these equity purchaser, sometimes they're called foreclosure reconveyance provisions in the various state statutes, and discovering that perhaps a better approach would be to consider them what's called an equitable mortgage, which means that it might look superficially like a transfer of the equity, but in fact it's treated as a mortgage. It really is more like a mortgage transaction. And in Oregon, we've adopted that concept both in case law and in statute, that if something is really at the heart of it a lending transaction and not a transfer of property, it's treated as a mortgage. So we're working on making that part of this equity purchaser provision. There are indicia that, for example, if the seller stays in the property and enters into an agreement with somebody who's supposed to be the purchaser, who's really a lender in the sort of sale leaseback, we had a conversation about, well, maybe that lease transaction should be recorded. So any subsequent purchaser, anybody trying to purchase a property, would be on notice. So there are indicia where it would defeat the sort of bona fide purchaser status. Somebody can't come in and say, wait a minute, I thought I was buying this property free and clear, when in fact the person who's supposed to be the seller is still living there with what looks like a lease.
So we're getting more help on that from the National Consumer Law Center, and we're going to be talking about whether that can be worked into this equity purchaser provision or it takes the place of it. So it's kind of a new idea that is consistent with what our case law is in Oregon. So we'll see how that goes. It's just an update on that.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer any other questions about this concept before I move on to the next one.
Just ask this one.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. This just happened yesterday with one of my constituents. You know, when senior citizens stay in their home, they are go on Medicaid, and their home is the equity, the payment. Eventually, when that person dies, their home is sold, and however much is owed the state or somebody is taken out, or the federal government. I don't know who it is. So here's what's happening, and this is a trend nationwide. Senior children are taking care of more senior parents in the home owned by the senior parent. And therefore, they're not working in other jobs because they're taking care of their senior parents. When that person dies, they take this home. And the issue yesterday was that DHS is supposed to have some type of program with a waiver. So these people who have taken care of their seniorist all these years are not immediately kicked out of these homes. And that's happening. It's horrid.
Chair Hovey, Vice Chair Nelson, the issue of assets when seniors are eligible for health benefits is a very big problem.
Yes.
And I think the federal government has eased off a bit on their regulations. The regulations are actually fairly draconian in terms of taking the property. And I think that we're making some progress, but there's definitely some big problems out there.
Thank you. You would move on to the next work group, I suppose.
The next concept, and I don't think I'll see anybody out there who... Well, actually, Jim, why don't you come on up? You can answer the hardball questions if... The foreclosure laws in Oregon have statutory requirements for notice. As Corey mentioned, a significant number, most foreclosures are trustee foreclosures. About 95% of foreclosures in Oregon are trustee foreclosures. The current statute is very complicated in terms of the notice. And I think that our last meeting that we had with these committees, we passed out the current statute, and I can certainly provide that again to anyone who's interested in it. What the subcommittee, the foreclosure notice subcommittee, looked at was to see if we could revise the notice to make it clearer to folks who are faced with foreclosure. And rather than take the existing statute and amend that statute, the decision was made to actually have a separate notice in the statute, which would have clear language and give people notice of their rights and what options they would have available. And the reason that we didn't amend the current statute is that there are other folks in the process who need to get notice, folks like junior lien holders and other folks who have an interest in the property. So rather than amending that statute, our goal was to have a separate statute which would provide the homeowner with the notice that what they would need to take some action. And the bullet points that I provided with you kind of gives you that outline. It does just provide apply to residential properties. It gives the homeowner notice that they're in danger of losing their property, and it gives them some specific information that they would need to basically take some action that could save their home. This is a concept that the industry has been very supportive of. No one wants to have the homeowner lose their home. It's not in anyone's interest, including industry, to have the banks or any other lending institutions take the property back. The reason is that as the market cools off, having an inventory of property, if you're a lender, is not a good thing. So it's in everyone's interest for that homeowner to stay in the home if at all possible. The notice.
Senator Westland.
Excuse me. We were interested in what you just said, and it makes perfect sense if you take it on, you know, at what you said. That makes sense. But a goodly number of these loans are not held by the original loan maker. Is that a fair statement?
Chair Westland, I think that's correct. But I would say that they are no more interested in taking the property back than the original lender. In fact, they may be even less interested.
No. I completely agree with that. The person that ends up owning the loan has every reason not to take the property back. But that's a very different person than the person or company that initiated the loan.
Chair Westland, I think that's right. And this notice is given at the end of the process. This notice is given at the time that the trustee has made the decision. With whoever the lender is at this point.
And I know we're talking about noticing, but you made the point, you know, the banks don't want to take the property back. The owner of the note doesn't want to take the property back. I totally agree. But I just want to make the point that where the loan started is usually very different than who is issuing the notice.
Senator Wilson, that's a fair statement.
I want to add, if Mr. Chair will allow me, that we were having this discussion after talking about how many borrowers don't contact the lender when they get a notice of foreclosure. And when we looked at the notice of sale, and it was full of legalese. Representative Riley's name came up a few times. And we thought it would be useful for that consumer to receive information that he or she could understand in plain English with some helpful phone numbers, lawyer referral, here's the number of your lender, here's how you can find out how much you owe. And hopefully that will help the consumer to take action rather than just become the denial or else not understand the significance of what's happening.
And Mr. Chair, if I could add, Jim Markey, on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association, which is the Oregon affiliate of MBA, Mortgage Bankers of America, usually the lender servicing the loan is the person in the best position to be able to help a person who is moving toward foreclosure out of that dilemma and find some alternatives for him. And we have some good things going for us in Oregon in terms of these people having more equity in their homes than in most places and some other things. But we're finding that almost a full half of the people that go into foreclosure never contact their lender. Throughout that process until they're out of the house, half never contact their lender. So anything we can do to encourage them to contact that lender is a good thing for everybody.
Thank you for that.
So, Chair Holding, on this concept, I guess the major points are to provide the homeowner in as clear language as possible the information that they're going to lose their home if they don't do something, and what those options are, whether it be to contact their lender to see if they could work out a payment plan or some other way to save their home, and then also giving them resources, counseling resources, so that they're not, if they need some additional help, they'll know where to go for that.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Do we have regulation around advertising for institutions or individuals that are putting out there that they can help people with their payments and foreclosures?
Is that a question?
No question.
No, Mr. Chairman, I think it probably goes to a question also included within that about what you can legally limit in terms of free speech in this state, in terms of, you can probably limit in terms of contracts, by law, but what you can limit in terms of how someone presents what they are offering.
Senator Devlin, Chair Holvey, there are some legitimate restrictions that you can place on advertising, particularly when it comes to fraud, that is an issue that we have been looking at. It's not anything that's addressed specifically in these concepts, except to the extent that the foreclosure consultant in this concept has got some very specific obligations in terms of what needs to be said, but this concept does not go to the advertising issue itself.
I guess we can follow up with that later. I mean, I'm just encouraged that I've heard some advertising from legitimate banks about helping folks with some potential problems with foreclosure and making their payments. And recently I've heard that, but I also, also have gotten advertisement from some that I would characterize as probably not being legitimate. And so I'm curious, when we start talking about registration and licensing, whether we're able to tie advertising into having a license to operate in this field or not.
Just a statement.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. I just want to mention this. Back to what Chair Holder was saying, I think it's very important. There are predators in this world called lenders who keep pushing home equity loans. And I would be very interested in knowing, how much of the foreclosure data is relative to individuals adding home equity loans. And, I mean, I must get 2 or 3 documents a week from somebody saying, borrow this, pay off your Visa, any debts, and, all of a sudden that home that cost $300,000 is now $500,000 and you're never going to pay it off. I'd be interested in knowing that, because it really is a push.
Well, if there are no other questions about the foreclosure notice issue, I'm going to ask Jim to stay up, and we'll talk about the last concept. One of the discussions that we've had for quite some time, and then the subcommittee of the work group has actually picked this up, it's a little bit behind the other work groups in terms of the number of meetings that it's had, and that involves enforcement on the DCBS enforcement with respect to loan originators. There's a widespread agreement in the industry that there ought to be additional enforcement tools with respect to loan originators. And so what this concept attempts to do is to give DCBS more authority to do that. And I just kind of outlined what that is. The sort of the short version is that the concept would have DCBS given the authority to bar either temporarily or permanently a loan originator from the industry for certain bad conduct. The way this works now is that a loan originator is employed by a broker, and Jim can speak to this as well. The broker's on the hook for this conduct, but oftentimes, and this is the exception, not the rule, but there are enough exceptions that it's a problem. There are loan originators who will engage in bad conduct while working for one broker, and then either get fired or move, and then go to another broker and engage in that same conduct, and kind of go from broker to broker. And there really is no way to get those bad actors out of the industry at this point, because our regulation now focuses on the broker. So this concept would give DCBS some authority in the case of a bad actor to basically say to the loan originator, you are out of the business, either temporarily or permanently, because you are engaging in conduct that's harmful to consumers.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Jim Markey again, Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. Our association is really strongly in favor of all of these concepts, particularly this one, I think. We really need to get a handle around how we treat these originators. Part of this is being looked at in the federal legislation, and in Congressman Frank's bill, there would be a national registry created of loan originators so that they could more easily be tracked. We're not sure, I'm not sure exactly who all that's going to include. I think we would advocate that it includes all originators. And that's important. And I think that then we need to have regulation and have the department have these kinds of tools to regulate these originators, but keeping in mind that originators are employees of other people, brokers or lenders, and there is a requirement that they be supervised at all times. And so the trick here is to have regulation of the originator without doing away with employer responsibility. We don't want to let that employer off the hook either. So that's kind of what this is an attempt to do, is meet that fine line and at least begin to move down that path.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Jim, I think everybody's aware of this terrible, tragic situation in our county where numerous Mexican families lost everything with some very illegal Mexican lenders. I mean, took everything. They took their huge down payment. These families that had saved and saved and saved and worked and worked. And the lending individuals, it doesn't matter that they were Mexicans or not, I'm just saying these were individuals who had come here, worked very, very hard here in America, and then their own ethnic group took advantage of them, and their language problems and things like that. It was horrid. So I'm really for this, and I hope we do require all individuals originating loans to be registered. And also, somehow the employer it needs to be responsible for his employees, who I think are agents of the originator. And I wish we'd add that to this first item here.
Chair, Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Nelson, I actually, you anticipated a comment that I was going to make, and that is that mortgage brokers are still on the hook for the conduct of their employees. So that does not change at all. They're going to be regulated just as they have been now, and will have the same standards in terms of conduct. What this does, though, is it gives the department the ability to go after those rogue originators who would go from broker to broker continue to engage in bad conduct. And the second piece that you mentioned, licensing, we actually do register loan originators now, and there are certain education requirements that they have to meet to get into the business. But once they're in, we don't feel that we have sufficient tools to take action if there's a problem.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On that subject, do you currently have a website or something which says these folks, these loan originators are not following good practice so that brokers can find out before they hire them?
Like bad doctors and sex offenders?
Mm-hmm.
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, I'm going to actually ask Mary Leslie to come up and comment on this pull chair.
For the record, Mary Leslie, Mortgage Lending Program Manager with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, Department of Consumer Business Services. We actually don't identify loan originators on our website, with the exception to allow consumers to actually perform a search to ensure that they are registered with us and have presumably met the education and background check requirements. What we do have on our website are final orders issued against mortgage lending companies in Oregon, so consumers and other interested parties can perform a search to see which of the licensed mortgage lenders have had problems.
And, Chair Holden, Representative Riley, I think that if we, meaning DCBS, were given this authority and we actually took action to bar someone, that's something that we would certainly want to make sure that other folks knew about.
Thank you.
Representative Bonici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you, Lou and Corey, done any sort of analysis of whether you would need additional staff at DCBS with these additional enforcement responsibilities?
I'm going to ask Corey to come up and answer that question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, again, Corey Strassinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And the issue of enforcement resources is always an open issue because we have enforcement staff. With the existing staff, we prioritize what we can do. We have, over the past couple of years, reprioritized within the department to add additional examination staff in the mortgage lending area because of our concerns in this area. So with additional resources, we can do more. With the existing resources, we prioritize. So whether this specific bill would require additional resources, the answer is it would not require additional resources, but it would be another call on our existing enforcement resources, which would, of course, again, require prioritization as to what else we could do. There's always more to do than we have the existing resources for.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else?
I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Any other questions from the committees? Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you talk about registration and licensure, those are not actually just two completely separate. There's all varieties of registration. There's all varieties of licensure. When you actually say someone should no longer be employed in a field or that they have violated things, it would appear to me that you're going to come into some we're going to have to answer some questions about due process in that, in terms of that the individual has been denied entry, so that there's going to have to be some clear basis for it. So I think that there is going to be an underlying cost factor in this. And then I think you have to answer the question, I've got a very high-producing loan originator that has a questionable history, and I'm the broker that employs him. What liability am I now assuming that this particular loan originator has been identified as engaging in questionable practices? Do you actually prohibit?
I probably ought to have Barry Leslie come up and answer the specifics on that. But there are currently requirements for background checks.
Fine. But I mean, if they found to engage in practices and then a broker still employs them, are there sanctions against the broker? Mm-hmm. Or would you envision sanctions against the broker?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, again, Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Right now, the lender is responsible for all of, or the broker is responsible for all of the conduct of anyone acting under their wing. So if the person handling cash absconds with the cash, they have a problem. If a loan originator engages in inappropriate conduct, they have a problem. And if they have knowingly hired somebody who has a history of engaging in bad conduct, I think on a civil liability basis, they have an even bigger problem. So we actually, and the reason that we have referred to this, that we register and we are not actually suggesting independent licensure of loan originators, is we don't believe it's the best enforcement tool, and we don't believe it's appropriate for our department to become the one who's responsible for determining who a loan originator or who a broker should hire. We think it's their responsibility to check the background and the professional credentials and to make sure that their loan originators are meeting a high professional standard. We do believe that it is appropriate to say that if someone's engaged in repeated bad acts, we can bar them from the industry, but we believe that it's appropriate for the mortgage brokers and mortgage lenders to be the ones on the front lines of determining who's got the qualifications and who's appropriate for them to hire, if that responds to your question.
Okay. And no one here would be talking about licensure to the point of creating a board. As someone who sent through too many Ways and Means committees going over small boards on licensure, I really don't like the concept of creating any more.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I will say that in my department we license many professions and we have few boards.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. I want to apologize to Barry. I should have said Ms. Leslie a while ago. Sorry. Instead of, I think the first name is Leslie. Corey, have we ever barred anybody? Any mortgage lender that had denied them? Have we ever penalized one to date?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we do sanction mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers. We have taken enforcement action.
How many would you say?
And actually, I'm going to have to ask Ms. Leslie to come back up because that's actually her field, and I don't know if we have numbers for this year or not. If not, we can get it to you, though.
Mary Leslie with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I think we've issued something like 22 orders to date in 2007 against Oregon mortgage lenders.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. In 1 year, 22?
To date in 2007.
And so when did you begin this practice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we did significantly increase our enforcement effort in early 2006, I believe. We started focusing on this area in over the past 2 to 2.5 years in particular.
So
it's not that we had done enforcement before, but we significantly cranked up the effort.
A quick follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
So would it be possible for us to have a list and know the reasons why?
Certainly.
Thank you, of 2006 and 2007. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Lou, do you think you're done?
I think we are done.
Well, thank you. I appreciate all the work that the task force is doing and the subcommittees as well, and I sincerely hope they continue to look at these issues, fine-tune them as we head towards February and 09. With that, I want to bring up a few more people that have been involved in the task force. Sort of a stakeholder's perspective, I'd like to have Shane Jackson and Matt Wallace come up. Good squad. Welcome, welcome. If you'd state your name for the record and give us a brief scenario, I guess, of what you'd like to talk about.
Hi. For the record, I'm Shane Jackson, lobbyist for the Oregon Coalition of Mortgage Originators, or OCMO, or OCMO, as we are sometimes referred to. I'd like to thank Chair Westman, Chair Holby, and the members of this committee for this opportunity to testify and clarify our position. The Oregon Coalition of Mortgage Originators is a new, freestanding, independent organization of mortgage brokers and loan originators operating in Oregon. The mortgage brokerage business has matured to a level that members of OCMO feel that they need organized representation at the Capitol. This is my first formal testimony for OCMO. I've testified before on other things. Mortgage brokers do a little over 30% of the residential loans in Oregon, with about 9,000 individuals registered with the state as mortgage brokers or loan originators. As I have said, OCMO is a new organization and is growing every day. We currently have a small core of individuals, but every day more people are joining. We are in direct communication with over 500 individuals in the mortgage business and expect over 100 participants at our next event. I'd like to point out that no one in Oregon wants to eliminate predatory lending in the residential mortgage market more than our members do. Our hope is that our continued participation in the law and rulemaking process helps us accomplish this goal. At the same time, the members of OCMO understand the need to offer products and services that respond to the needs of the modern Oregonian and reflects the evolving use of residential real estate. Mortgage brokers have been in the forefront in soliciting more flexible, efficient, cheaper, and appropriate products for the customer. Products that let customers thrive and prosper, because when customers thrive, so does a mortgage broker's business. The result of this new level of service is that many more people have been able to achieve home ownership. People like waiters, waitresses, cab drivers, self-employed carpenters, and small business owners. These new products have given the people the freedom to better themselves and society by going back to school or getting training for better paying jobs and bringing happiness by allowing elderly people to stay in their homes for a few more years. People who 30 years ago would have never qualified for a loan. It is true that when a market evolves and expands as rapidly as ours has over the last 7 years, products may be misapplied and people will make mistakes. Things will be misrepresented by some to some, sometimes with tragic consequences. It is these issues that have brought us here. We, Oregon Coalition of Mortgage Originators, feel that the formation of the Mortgage Lending Workgroup has been an effective way for us as a group of responsible parties to attempt to answer these issues. And for that, the governor, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and this joint committee should be applauded. On behalf of OCMO, thank you for allowing us a place at the table. That said, OCMO would like to add that we support the work of the subcommittees. In particular, we would like to say that the foreclosure consulting and rescue legislation and the recommendations for the changes to the foreclosure process should be firmed up and passed this February. We would also like to say that the work of the data subcommittee
was extremely useful in isolating the issues particular to Oregon, and because of their outstanding work, you now have numbers that are as good as they get on which to base your decisions and on which to craft legislation. Additionally, though, we feel that the legislation being put forward would benefit from the addition of private bonding for all loan originators. We feel that this simple act will protect the customer and increase the quality of mortgages by eliminating individuals who have exhibited inappropriate behavior in their personal lives and by not allowing them to bring these habits into the mortgage industry. Oregon has a lot to be proud of. As the first state in the country to require educational requirements for our mortgage brokers and as early adopters of insurance requirements, we have avoided a lot of turmoil. I urge you to consider the work group recommendations and pass the suggested legislation about the rescue issues and changes to the foreclosure process. We would also like to keep the dialogue open about bonding loan originators. Thank you for your time and this opportunity.
Thank you for that. Any questions from the committee and this panelist? Senator Westland.
I'd just like to thank Mr. Jackson for his very full and robust participation in the work group, and then ask you, Shane, in your proposal with regard to the private bonding. I think there's an implication in there if you're bonding individuals, or is that individuals or firms?
When you, Chair Hogan, Chair Westland, when you bond, you bond the individual. You don't bond the firm. It is a person who is bonded, and then they will be taking that bonding with them. If they were going from broker to broker to broker, they would be moving with that bonding assignment. And if you don't qualify for bonding, then ideally you won't be able to get a job.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
And implicit in that would be some form of registration, a registry or a licensure process.
Chair Hovey, Senator Westland, all loan originators are registered in the state of Oregon. What we would like to see is that as part of that registration process, you provide your bonding information. Idaho does it. Many other states do it.
Thank you.
It brings a question up. Are they required to have errors and omissions insurance as well?
No, this is, Chair Hovey, this is not insurance. This is assurance. And bonding, so you would not require, you're bonding the behavior of an individual, not their impacts and effects. So it would not be covering E&O.
Do you think that there should be E&O for licensees?
I do not think that insurance should be required for loan originators. But I do think bonding should be required for loan originators, and so do many of my support members of my organization.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. I know from private business that I've been in, bonding is very expensive. And so what do you base, am I required to carry a $1 million bond, a $10,000 one? What?
Chair Hovey, Representative Nelson, thank you for that question. Right now in Oregon, a mortgage broker is required to carry a $10,000 bond. And on that $10,000 bond, they are paying $200 a year. So it would really, if we were to extend the bonding to the loan originators, it would probably be around $10,000 a year, and they would probably do it for $200. Idaho does it, and it's about $200 a year for many of the firms that operate in Idaho that also operate in Oregon. And you can buy it online. You can get your bonding insurance online. So,
yeah. Cool. Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Jackson, for that. Next panelist would like to start with your name and organization, please.
Be happy to. For the record, my name is Matt Wallace. I work with OSPIRG, the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. I'd like to thank Chairs Westman and Hovey and the members of the committee for the opportunity to speak with you here today about this very important issue. First, I suppose I should briefly introduce myself. Again, my name is Matt Wallace. I'm OSPIRG's consumer associate. OSPIRG is a statewide citizens-based public interest advocacy organization with a 30-year history of working on public interest issues, everything from health care to lending issues to product safety. Many of you, of course, know OSPIRG advocate Laura Etherton, who currently serves on the mortgage lending work group. And again, wanted to thank you all for the opportunity to speak here today on the issue. I'd also like to echo earlier comments by Ms. Streisinger about just the amount of work that I understand has gone into the mortgage lending work group and all the time that's been put on both by members of DCBS legislators here today and many community members and representatives from the lending industry. I wanted to talk to you about the importance here today, the main purpose of addressing lending practices in the mortgage lending issue. And then before I get into that and into the specifics, I think everyone here knows that we are facing a really significant problem when it comes to sort of the collapse of the subprime market and the mortgage lending issues in general. I mean, these are issues that are in the news almost every day. Just yesterday there was a piece about in the Oregonian about building permits being down about 30%, and the analysis is that's very much tied up in the economic crunch that we're seeing because of mortgage lending nationally here in Oregon, or the collapse of that market. And so, you know, it's a serious problem. Actually, I think Senator Westman was put it very eloquently. One thing that's unique about Oregon is that we may not be as far behind or as far underwater, as the rest of the country, but we're still we're facing some significant problems, and they're problems that need to be addressed. I'm here, among other things, to say that we are disappointed that as of yet the Lending Practices Subcommittee reports a lack of consensus, and as a result that no recommendations have been made to address the significant and we believe very central role that lending practices play in the issue of mortgage lending, and we're concerned that without a significant change in course that the work group may only recommend the policies that were outlined for you today, and then I won't summarize those again, but while these proposals will help families that are in the final stage of losing their home, and that's significant, they do nothing, unfortunately, to protect families on the most important day, which is the day that they sign their loan paper. The problem in Oregon, again, is significant. The projections, of course, vary for how many foreclosures we will expect to see over the next year and over the next several years, but all projections that we will see an increase in foreclosures. And I think some of the data from the subcommittee on data, one slide that was interesting, and I can't actually remember which slide it was, but shows how many loans are going to reset in the next year or the next year and a half, and that's a number that's over 15,000. So not only are we expecting to see foreclosures increase, these are obviously issues that need to be addressed. These individuals need a way out and need options to help them. But we're also can expect as these loans reset, as loans that started out at a low interest rate for 2 years or 3 years or 5 years or even a teaser interest rate reset to monthly payment increases anywhere from $400 to $1,200, we can expect to see an increase in the number of homeowners who will be refinancing their houses and looking for new loan products over the next few years as a result of these huge increases in payments. And so for that reason, we believe that now is a critical time to address the mortgage lending practices that will help protect those homeowners, those home buyers, whether they're first time or looking for refinancing options, to protect them and make sure that they get the best loans that are available to them and ones that will protect them in the future. So there are some specifics that we think would benefit this kind of legislation, and then the written testimony, but I'll outline them very briefly. We believe that legislation to meaningfully address this issue must establish affirmative duties for creditors, and that lenders and brokers should ensure that a loan or refinancing arrangement, you know, is in the borrower's financial interest, that there's a net tangible benefit for a borrower in one of these situations. And this must include, at minimum, full and clear disclosure of what they call yield spread premiums, which are, you know, essentially compensation that a broker or originator can get for selling a particular loan product to a borrower. We believe that disclosure of those premiums and that compensation is important to reduce the incentive for brokers to steer home buyers into loans that may not include the best rates and lowest fees that the borrower qualifies for. We also believe that lenders must be honest with borrowers about what they can afford and qualify borrowers based on the fully indexed rate of the loan, which is not currently a requirement. Any proposed legislation should include strong requirements for lenders to underwrite borrowers, not based on the teaser rate, whether that's 6 months or two years or 3 years or 5 years, but based on the fully indexed price of the loan. And additionally, we believe that abusive prepayment penalties must be eliminated, and legislation must protect consumers by limiting excessive fees. Many subprime loans include prepayment penalties, which are essentially fees that the borrower has to pay in order to get out of their loan, to buy a new loan, to refinance, and get into a new loan product. We believe that those should be eliminated outright, and we do also believe that overall fees should be limited to a reasonable rate of 5% of the total loan amount for most home loans. And finally, simply that the legislation just must include clear enforcement and legal remedies for violations, which is something, of course, that we are making progress on, but we want to make sure that continues to be clarified and set up. And really, it's time for Oregon to join the growing list of states that have already passed strong consumer protection laws when it comes to mortgage lending. Lending standards would help ease the transition to a more fair and affordable mortgage for the 15,000 Oregonian families who will soon receive, you know, that painful notice that monthly rates are about to increase dramatically. So on behalf of Osberg, I'd like to urge Oregon's elected officials, the members of these committees, to implement significant reforms to mortgage lending practices in the next available opportunity. It is really a time for the American dream of home ownership to really be rebuilt on a foundation of renewed trust between lender and borrower. And thank you for the opportunity to share that with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Matt. Do you know how many states have either banned or limited prepayment penalties?
I don't know the exact number, although I actually just printed out something that has a summation of those states. And I believe the number is at least seven or eight have fully and completely banned prepayment penalties as part of their mortgage lending laws. There are a number of states that have already passed legislation just this year. Maine is one of them that recently passed legislation that addresses a number of these issues.
Mr. Chair, just one quick question.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much. I don't know, maybe Jim needs to come up and answer this one too. Thank you for being here. One of the issues that bothers me that I've had to help constituents on is this, how you handle disputes between the customer, the consumer, and the mortgage broker, not just banker brokers.
Mm-hmm.
It appears to me that it's always, there's an arbitration clause, and we're going to arbitration, and you lose, consumer, most generally. This is what has been the cases. I just wonder, what can be done about this? This is, usually the individual who's suffering from difficult times or issues cannot afford, high-priced lawyers like mortgage bankers can. So it appears to me that that's a very tough situation, and I wonder how you feel about it, and how can we have equal, representation for the consumer as well as the banker or the broker.
Chair Holy, Representative Nelson, I think that's a great point. Also, quickly, I just realized I abandoned decorum in my response to the last question, so I'd like to apologize for that. It's my first opportunity as well to testify before these committees. But again, Representative Nelson, your question, I think that's a great point. And the details and specifics of of how to reconcile conflicts between, you know, a borrower and, you know, and a lender. You know, it's a fairly complex issue and one that I'm not the most expert on, but I do know that mandatory arbitration, you know, is something that that we feel is definitely, as you mentioned, you know, not beneficial to the consumer, and that there need to be other options for the consumer to pursue.
Could I ask Shane to answer that?
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson. The arbitration issue is very difficult, but I think we would like to, our goal long term would be to create rules and regulations where we don't need to go to arbitration and where people can just solve. We have a very clean process of getting people in and out of the properties and mortgage products that they need where we don't have the conflicts. That would be ideally for me.
Thank you. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm always a little bit concerned here that we don't leave people with an impression of what we may be doing in terms of the future and what impact we might have on people that will that do currently have some problems that could not actually will not be able to actually service them and may go into foreclosure. The work group and even everything that you presented, and I don't actually see an alternative to this, what's going to happen to that person basically is that if we improve some of the notification and information about foreclosure, they may be able to protect some of their equity. They also, trying to think of this in a way, we may shield them from an unscrupulous provider that's trying to sell them a product that'll even put them in a worse situation. But because of the way the market has changed, that person who was unqualified clearly in some ways to service that loan long term when they got the loan is not going to find a lender willing to loan to them now. So I think that's one of the realities I want to get here is that, and I don't think there's a way to change that because fundamentally people entered into loans, some of them with their eyes wide open. My eyes would be wide open if somebody actually said I could buy a house for $300,000 and I'd pay $1,000 a month. And some that probably didn't realize what they were doing. But nothing here is actually going to prevent some of these parties from actually losing their homes. And no one here, rightfully, because we do not have the resources as a state to do this, is talking about bailing people out. The people you say that so that they can get the best mortgage that's available to them, many of those people will probably not have lenders willing to lend to them. So I just wanted to put that on the record. I don't want us to give the implication here that we're somehow going to resolve some of the problems for some of the people that are going to be foreclosed on beyond what limited things we can do.
Sure. And yeah, Chair Holby, Senator Devlin, that's an excellent point. And it is, you know, tragic that we're, you know, in a situation where there are folks that are going to lose their houses because of the, you know, the bad loans that they got into, whether that was, you know, whether they entered into it with their eyes wide open or whether they, you know, whether they didn't. These loan products are obviously very complicated and pretty complex. Terms like 30-year exploding arms with balloons, you know, occasionally, you know, conjure some fanciful images. But I think that, you know, the thing that we don't need to do is, you know, while it's very possible that they may have more trouble finding loans at this point, the last thing that we want to do is get them into another bad loan product, which is why the importance, I think, of reforming lending practices and making sure that that's the case is something that needs to be addressed as soon as possible.
Senator Westland.
Here's the yin and the yang of it. And I don't know, Matt, if this was in your verbal remarks, and I'm scanning quickly and I can't find it in your provided testimony. But the key to this, the most important day is the day of the loan. And that's where the consumer protection has to be provided. But at the same time, we as public policymakers have an obligation also to keep the industry vibrant and robust. If you want to send Oregon into a huge recession, crater the mortgage banking industry. Having said that, the key point is a knowledgeable consumer, aware, and having reasonable confidence that on that most important day, they are getting the best loan available for their particular circumstance. And that may mean, in the consumer's protection, that there are some loans that don't get made. Because, Donna, your point, arbitration and remedies after the fact, you still have lives, that litter the side of the road. So,
okay.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Thank you for your testimony. I really appreciate both of you coming forward and giving your perspectives on this. And running just a little bit over, but if there's any other stakeholders or anybody in the audience that would like to make comments on the task force recommendations or mortgage lending as we move forward, you're welcome to come forward. Mr. Marquis, I see your hand go up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. First, I just wanted to thank Representative Holby, Bonamici, Senator Westland for their participation in the work group. I think it's been a good process. I hope that the discussions will continue beyond into 08 as we move forward and look at what the federal government is doing and what we might need to do to enhance it. I do want to say, though, that things, Senator Westland remarked that 2 inches underwater is still bad, even if you're not 2 feet like somebody else. But I do want to point out that in Oregon, our foreclosure rates today are about right where they were in 2005. And that's just a fact. So they are on the rise. But they're substantially below where they were in 2002. And the folks that are in subprime loans here have 17% equity in their homes on the average, when in California that figure is 5%, in San Diego it's a negative number, and in Florida it's a negative number. So our citizens will have some options available to them that other folks don't. And I'd like to think that part of the reason that we don't have the problem here is that you folks did a better job early on when you passed legislation that required brokers to be licensed here, bonded. And we regulate, I think we do a better job in Oregon of regulating the industry than in many other states. So all is not doom and gloom here. I just want to point that out.
Thank you. One last comment, Representative Nelson.
Yes, because I think this is important, and thank you all for caring. I do believe I see empathy for the consumer here, and I am forever grateful. I just want to give you a scenario. Around the corner where I live is a wonderful family, but the dad lost his job. So what do they do to, save their house? Is they use the money they had in savings that was going to put a kid through college. And so now that's depleted. He hadn't got a temporary job, but it doesn't pay accordingly. So somewhere, like Senator Westland, mentioned, and Senator Devin, we need some kind of empathy, some kind of a program that when, you know, you lose a job, you don't lose your house. You know, when you lose a job, you don't lose your children's future. So some alternative lending sources when tough times hit, you know. But I know tough people, you know, can make it through tough times, but some of these, when they're the financial portion of it, it's very difficult. And then especially when we have an inflationary period and increases in taxes, what I just mentioned earlier, you know, really wipe these people out. And the same family had the same problem that I just had when I got my property tax statement. They can't afford, you know, another $100 a month.
Thank you, and before we move on, I'd like to turn it over to the administrator to note some testimony that we're putting into the record, so it would be available. We're not going to actually read that testimony. But
no, thank you, Chair Holby. Yes, and for you and in your packets, our committee members, you have two pieces of written testimony, respectively, from Rick Bennett of AARP Oregon and Phil Goldsmith, who is a private attorney in Portland.
Thank you for that. Again, I appreciate all the input, and as we listen to this, I thought it was rather interesting listening to Bernanke, the Federal Reserve Chairman, talking about this issue yesterday. He had some interesting comments about why we're in this situation and what the federal government is doing, and I know we're going to be keeping our eye on that federal legislation as we move forward on these issues as well. So with that, I don't know, Senator Westland, you have any comments you'd like to make?
I will just gavel out the Senate Interim Committee on Commerce and Labor. We are adjourned.
Thank you for that, and the House Committee on Interim Committee on Consumer Protection will be closing the informational hearing, and we're going to open a work session. And the purpose of the work session is just to move forward with a request and a motion to have legislation drafted concerning mortgage lending for foreclosure and loan origination, and we will take that. Do I hear a motion?
Move.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the committee approve the drafting request you outlined.
Thank you. Are there any objections to that?
I actually would like to throw some stuff into the record as to why I'm going to vote the way I'm going to vote. First of all, subprime loans, I think that the people that issue subprime loans usually are issuing those loans to people of lesser means and are taking a tremendous amount of risk. I think my hat goes off to them, and the fact is that home ownership in this state is up to the highest amount it's ever been. The second thing is we've had the fiasco of 965, which would have been catastrophic on the industry. And, you know, what you're asking for is a carte blanche in order to write a piece of legislation that I have no idea what it's going to entail. Third is the rules that are set out for this interim session. A, I think they're illegal. I think they're grossly unfair. For example, the minority party cannot write any of its own bills. It can't progress with any of its own bills. And I think that that is just terribly unfair, and I also think it's unconstitutional. There are certain issues that I think need to be brought up that this does not qualify as an emergency. First of all, there are things that I do think qualify for emergency. State police in rural areas, project independence funding, the Big Look outlook, timber receipts on federal issues, harvest of state forest land, illegal aliens. I think those are all things that are of an emergency status. This hardly qualifies for an emergency. However, having said that, I do feel sympathetic for some things when it comes to foreclosures and the foreclosure scams that are out there. And if the bill is restricted to that, I would probably vote for it. So I'm going to vote yes, only because I don't wish to impede progress. But I think that I probably will be a no vote, given the history of this committee, as far as the other outcome goes.
Well, I guess your qualified support is appreciated. But I will, you know, just reiterate that we're hoping to move forward with the task force recommendations, and the task force will continue to work on these issues. We're going to be working with leadership from both parties and from both sides of the building on this issue as we go forward. And certainly when the bill is finalized, because we don't know all the details of it yet, we certainly have a lot to work with and a lot of good work that we're going to be able to get drafting started. But I'm sure it will evolve until February, and in February we'll be able to look at it and cast your vote one way or the other at that. So,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I would just like to express my opinion, if I could. I think, you know, it's just like the veterans coming home. They would tell our veteran committee, you know, there's nothing like having a home to come home to. Most important item for a family. I can't think of anything worse than, you know, having a severe illness, losing a job, and then, you know, losing a relative, close friend, and then losing your home. I think this is so important. Preventive medicine is always the best. So I think any time anybody's facing a foreclosure, it's an emergency and it's happening every day. So I think this is a very critical, time-worthy issue, and let's move forward quickly.
Thank you. So with that motion, do I have any objections? Hearing none, the motion's adopted. So with that, I appreciate everybody being here, and I'm going to close the work session on the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection.
Yeah, something to me. How about that?